Thank you for tuning into episode 137 of Speaking of Mysteries. I'm Nancy Clare, and the guest for this podcast is Ben Dolnick, whose fourth novel, The Ghost Notebooks, is a be-careful-what-you-wish-for genre-bending blend of mystery, ghost tale, and love story. I have to admit that I have a weakness for stories that color outside the lines of so-called genre constructs, and I would urge all mystery fiction fans to consider giving novels such as The Ghost Notebooks a read. Here's Ben Dolnick. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and I'm delighted that we have Ben Dolnick on the podcast today, whose The Ghost Notebooks was published last week. So welcome, Ben.
It's great to be here.
First of all, congratulations. Your pub day was last week on The Ghost Notebooks, which I believe is your third novel or your fourth?
Fourth.
So here's my first question. And don't get me wrong, I love genre-bending fiction. But if you were in charge of shelving your novel, where would you put it? A mystery? A ghost story? A love story?
Right. It's tricky. Yeah, this is... maybe one of the few situations in which a virtual shelf might function better than an actual physical set of shelves, because it is sort of somewhere between those things or overlapping those things. I think, you know, one of my big interests in the book was the things I set out to do. I had a sort of lifelong love of mysteries and genre and stuff. You know, I grew up reading a lot of, like, Stephen King, and before that, you know, Christopher Pike and stuff, and then graduated into Ruth Rendell and Scott Turow and John McDonald and blah, blah, blah. But I had never really had occasion to incorporate it into fiction. I also, you know, pursued literary fiction a lot. And so with this one, I wanted to see if I could sort of create this strange hybrid that would bring what, you know, attracts me about genre fiction, just the attention to plot and the speed and the, you know, respect for the reader having a good time, basically. And if I could grasp that onto what I love in literary novels, which is, you know, basically feeling something and the closeness of attention to language. Not that genre novels don't often do all that, but you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, and I've discussed the idea of the contrast between literary fiction and genre fiction a lot with many of the writers I've spoken to. I would like to think that all of the writers that I've spoken to, including Bob Craze and Michael Connelly and Nick Harkaway, with whom you share this genre-bending kind of approach, are all literary novelists. They all have respect for the language and story, and so it, I guess literary novel has as many definitions as there are people who enjoy them.
Yeah, and I think almost certainly all of the definitions are sort of dusty and limiting and off-putting, and I would probably just as soon, you know, scrap the whole system and just say these are stories, these are books, you know, just dive in and see what it's like.
See if it engages you.
But
regardless of the genre that you or a writer might pick, The Ghost Notebooks is very much a be careful what you wish for and the grass is not always greener kind of story. And so I was wondering, you live in New York City. Did you mean it as a cautionary tale for city dwellers to think that the answer to their prayers was moving to an isolated house in the country, which of course is always a place where things might go very, very wrong?
Exactly, yeah. Well, it wasn't explicitly a cautionary tale in that way, but I think the broader principle you're outlining of just the human inclination to imagine that over the next hill, whether that hill will be getting married or having a baby or finding the perfect house or finding the perfect job, that happiness lies somewhere over there, is, you know, a very dangerous delusion. Usually it's not dangerous in the actual life imperiling sense. But yeah, I think that is something that I was interested in playing with and sort of blowing up in this book, if I could.
We should talk about the plot a little bit. It's described really accurately on the flap as the story of two people, a young man and a young woman, who are involved. They're living together. Both of their careers are sort of flatlining, which is a similar sort of setup to Gone Girl and many other successful novels. And one of the two gets an offer to go to upstate New York to be sort of the in-house historian, curator of this museum. So that's what sets up the story. And I'm wondering, where did that particular idea come from?
Well, so my wife worked for years here in Brooklyn, actually, at a historic house here. So in Brooklyn, there is a giant park called Prospect Park, and in that park there is a house from the 1600s called the Lefferts House that is a museum. Kids go there and they churn butter and dress up in old clothes and learn about the Dutch history of New York and stuff like that. And so my wife worked there. She was the director eventually. And so I spent a lot of time there just, you know, picking her up or hanging out and you know, sort of daydreaming stories, which is what I sort of always do. And it so happened we were driving past it one night. You could see it from a particular avenue when you made a turn. And I said to her that, I don't know why, but whenever we make this particular drive, I always imagined kind of coming upon the house on fire. So it was very easy to picture sort of flames shooting out of the roof of this little old wooden house. And she said, oh, that's so weird, I do that too. And so something about that image, I think, sort of lodged in my brain and made me think I might want to write something involving a historic house museum. It ended up, you know, being set obviously somewhere other than Brooklyn in a totally different kind of museum. But just that whole world of historic houses seemed to have a sort of funny, vivid, spooky potential to me.
And, of course, one of the constructs of your novel is a mainstay of mystery and crime fiction, which is that the past and the different interpretations people have of the events that have taken place is always with us. So, in a way, regardless of whether or not you believe in ghosts, we're haunted.
Yeah, I think that's well put. I spent a lot of time, you know, trying to figure out how I wanted the past to be present in this book, both, you know, structurally, like, did I want to have excerpts from old things? Did I want the old stories to be sort of interwoven? My epiphanies are often sort of stupid and random, but I have a little piano keyboard in the room where I write, and I was sitting at it one night and just noodling around the way I do, and was struck by just like the way the piano is built, like the octaves, you know, it repeats over and over from low to high, just over and over the same notes. And something about that structure suddenly struck me as like a perfect way to conceive of a book, that the past, that you can have the same sorts of suffering and stories and lives just sort of repeating like a melody at all these different ranges. And so that solved something inner that I had been struggling with.
Well, it's a ghost story, or maybe not a ghost story, but I have to ask if you believe in ghosts, or maybe believe is too strong a word, if you think there is a possibility that there might be ghosts.
Yeah, I mean, I have never personally had any sort of ghost-suggested encounter, I don't think.
Well put.
But I am extremely open to the possibility that, in fact, I'm almost certain that we are deeply, deeply wrong about some very fundamental things. that, you know, one of my favorite things to think about is that just as there were eras when educated people thought for certain that, you know, the sun went around the earth or that man had been divinely created or whatever, we too are carrying around some little unexploded assumptions that are centuries from now or decades from now going to look insane. And so I'm very open to the possibility that one of those revolutions might shed some light on ghosts. I don't think it will be, you know, Casper the Friendly Ghost that is revealed, but there might be some thing that we're not even conceiving of regarding death or what happens that will, in retrospect, we'll be able to say, oh, that is what people were talking about. That's what they were experiencing when they had some sort of encounter with ghosts.
Death, reincarnation, energy that remains, all of that, I guess, is...
Exactly. Yeah, that whole paranormal range.
I also saw this story as being about the sanctity of legacy. Hannah, who is the woman in the book, seems to be caught between a revisionist history of this man, Edmund Wright, who is the home, which has been turned into a museum, is called the Wright House, which I found interesting, and a more accurate take on Mr. Wright's definitive issues, and he certainly had issues.
Right. Yeah, I think so. I mean, that is one of, to me, the very interesting things about all history. I mean, I saw a lot of that at my wife's history museum, is the difference between the sort of sanitized, simplified stories that come down, particularly if it's a history geared toward kids, versus the just complexities and uncertainties and suffering and all of the messy human stuff that makes up an actual life. You know, I love reading the journals of, you know, like William James, for instance, is an author I really like, and I thought about a lot when I was writing this character, Edmund Wright. And I love going from his very polished, careful things, like varieties of religious experience, to his journals and his letters, where you see this much messier, more insecure, anxious, angry self, you know, coming in and out. So I'm very interested in how those people exist kind of underneath the shiny statue version.
Right, sort of the real story. And fortunately, right, your sentences are quite a bit shorter than William James's, however, so I'm thankful for that.
Yes, those can take some untangling.
As I was reading it, Hannah and Nick have gone off to live in this house. They've left behind what I consider sort of overprotective parents on Hannah's part. And I mean, one half of the couple has overprotective parents, and the other has sort of indifferent, affectionate indifference, I would call it, Nick's parents.
That's a good term for it.
And I'm just wondering what kept Hannah from confiding in Nick when they were living in the Wright House. I mean, what was it in her personality and in her nature that kept her from saying, you know, there's something going on?
Well, I think part of it, and you know, in some ways an author is maybe the last person who should be interpreting their own book, but I think part of it is that what she was experiencing and part of what was horrifying her and driving her crazy was an over-vivid perception of her future, including her future with Nick. And so I think the fact that that had become horrifying to her, that something about it was as terrifying as if she was being shown, you know, a vision of hell or something, was naturally something that she probably wouldn't want to confide in him. And particularly, you know, there is, when you fear that you might be losing your mind, you know, there's always this ambiguity about whether you're having an actual supernatural experience or if you are just crazy. And I think for cultural or personal or whatever reasons, that can often bring up a lot of shame and secrecy in people.
And of course, to me, that's very central to the book. Did she feel like she was going insane, or was she having paranormal experiences? I mean, I don't want to introduce too many spoilers to the book because it's a fascinating story and it takes you on this sort of really thought-provoking journey. But that must have been part of it. I mean, I don't want to, project into the book.
No, absolutely. I'm very interested in madness and, yeah, just how indistinguishable it is that you know, we live in our minds, and so if something is going on in the world that is horrifying and new, or if we are simply losing our mind, is often not only hard to tell, but maybe even doesn't matter, because, you know, the experience can be identical.
Which, of course, kind of makes this book very good for right now. I mean, those of us, I do try to keep this a politics-free zone, but many people, many thoughtful people, many people who read books are having kind of a tough time and asking themselves, is it me or is it sort of collective?
Right. Yeah, I think this has genuinely, I think, been a year of wondering almost every day, am I going insane? Is the world insane? And yeah, that, you know, sounds like a tacky cartoon or something, but in the actual experience of it can be really disorienting and awful.
And so this book is, to a certain extent, almost a microcosm, which is interesting because books, as my listeners and as people who've written them know, are not a year-long process. They're usually a two-year-long. It takes a year to write one and a year for the book to be published. So
yeah,
you were sort of anticipating this collective dysfunction that we're all seem to be operating with right now.
Yeah, I think the seeds of this sort of stuff have sort of been in the ground for a long, long time, for better or worse, probably for worse.
And of course, now we actually are living through it.
Right.
I'm curious where a writer goes after a genre-bending book like this. So what are you working on now?
It's still sort of early provisional days. So I don't yet, you don't want to announce a pregnancy too early on the case that something happened. So I'm not entirely certain what it's going to end up being. But I continue to be very interested in that kind of genre-bending project. You know, how much, basically, how much fun and how much feeling can you simultaneously pack into a book continues to be very interesting to me. And I love, at the moment, I'm reading Treasure Island and I'm rereading Alice Munro. So like that blend of plot and just sort of deep feeling continues to be kind of my North Star.
Well, as I mentioned before, it does remind me of other writers that I enjoy reading that plumb two different depths. One is Nick Harkaway, who wrote Angel Maker and Tiger Man. I don't know if you're familiar with either of those.
I haven't read them, but I do know him.
And, I always find that kind of fascinating. And then another writer is Peter Klein, who it's more science fiction, but it's also science fiction mystery. And those are, I think they're a great way for people to break out of an adherence to a genre. And since this is my podcast, I can do that.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think it's very fun to sort of play in the space between genres.
And, of course, that you're reading Treasure Island makes me think that perhaps there might be an element of adventure.
I love adventure. That I really do. I don't think it'll be as specific as pirates or anything, but I would love to capture some of that spirit that, you know, you feel, or I felt as a kid reading, of just, you know, here we go off into, whether it's an actual new world or just a kind of audacity that you as a person would never actually do. I love that feel, that sort of heart in your throat feeling as a reader of, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe we're going to do this.
And of course, now that this isn't one of my pre-thought out questions, but now that I think of it, the Ghost Notebooks does have that element of adventure because Nick and Hannah do go off. They don't know what they're going to expect. Sometimes adventures can be fulfilling and fun, and sometimes they can be not fulfilling and not fun.
Yeah, adventure has kind of a, you know, almost cozy, let's go off and have a picnic sound to it, but, you know, the North Pole is an adventure. Yeah, adventures can be terrifying. Adventures can be fatal.
Adventures can lead to cannibalism.
Right, exactly.
And on that cheery note, I want to thank you for joining us and talking about the Ghost Notebooks. I think it's a really terrific read and not as predictable as you might think it would be.
That's great. Thank you so much.